that you're born an Italian. If you want your life to be great, see that you're born an Italiano and your life will be great. From the moment you're a small bambino, you eat pizza, you drink vino.
Then they make you roly-poly.
You get stuffed with ravioli. If your mama's a paisano, you will have the world on a plate. So see that you're born an Italiano and your life will be great.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Italian-American Podcast. I'm John Viola, getting to spend the day with my buddy, the Italian-American Wikipedia, Patrick O'Boyle. And we have a very special guest with us today that I'm going to introduce as best I can. But she is a former colleague of Pat's and an expert on a very interesting topic, and one that we've been hoping to speak about for a long time here on the show, one that I don't know too much about, but fascinates me. So I'm going to cut right to it, Pat, and I'm going to introduce our guest, if that's okay with you.
It's an honor to have her here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to
it. It's a milestone in our academic pursuit as a podcast to have Reba here. So it's a great honor. It's a great day. Pop the champagne. We're going to learn a lot today. So with that, John, take the ball and run.
Well, it is a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Reba Wissner, who is an assistant professor of the Schwab School of Music at Columbus State University in Columbus, Georgia. She has been on the music history faculty of Montclair State University, New York University, Westminster Choir College of Rider University, and Ramapo College of New Jersey, and obviously got to know Pat, I'm assuming, at their time together at Montclair State, where Pat is part of the faculty there, an adjunct professor. And Reba is probably the greatest expert out there on a topic that I think really means a lot to us and our audience, which you may not particularly know about. It would, in the Neapolitan, it's called Sceneggiata. It's the traditional theater of the, how would you say, Pat, of the...
It's
a popular theater of the Neapolitan people. Is that right?
Yeah, I would, and Reba's the expert, and please correct me, Reba, if I misarticulate this, but Sceneggiata is an acting, a performance. It's like a Neapolitan song would be sung and would be kind of acted out at the same time, kind of performed, physically performed. Reba, how would you define it? And yeah, first, let me say, we've said you were going to come on for years. I'm so happy you're here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to finally be able to be here. So I think that a lot of your viewers, if not all of your viewers, may have seen a Sceneggiata, but just didn't realize that they saw one. And that was in The Godfather Part Two. What's really cool about that theater is that that was part of a Sceneggiata written by Francis Ford Coppola's grandfather, Francesco Pinino, who was one of the greatest Italian-American Sceneggiata composers. And so it what's really cool about that is that he he doesn't like people to see his grandfather's papers. He has all of his grandfather's papers. A few of us have tried, and he just doesn't want to let them out of his sight. So this is, I think, the only staged version of one of his grandfather's works that is out there.
And that's Senza Mamma. That is the most Neapolitan.
It is.
You can't. Like, you could not beat that. Mario Merola on his best day could not top that.
I was going to ask Reba about that, because that is probably the only version of this that I've seen. And Sceneggiata Napoletana is obviously an art form that we're going to talk about that has lasted from basically post-World War I kind of through to today, with different peaks and valleys in its longevity. But in the English language, you would think of it as Italian-American immigrant theater. And for most of us, that's probably the closest we've come to seeing it, is that brief scene in the second Godfather film where Don Vito Corleone and Clemenza meet in this theater, in this very dark, smoky theater, to see a play going on in the Neapolitan language. And Senza Mamma is the song that I think everybody has taken away from that experience and from that brief scene. It's one that I've played over and over again. And my wife and I always joke that whenever she leaves our dog, that's what he's singing in his head, Senza Mamma, because he doesn't like to be alone in the house.
Your dog is Neapolitan?
he's a British bulldog, but we
I never saw Rocco as Neapolitan.
He misses his mother every time she leaves, so probably the case. But yeah, that this is a topic that's come up over and over again. I can remember watching documentaries on the Italian American experience growing up, and they filmed a section of it, a portion of it, at the Amato Opera House, I believe it was called. It was a company that was doing operettas, and they were still doing some of these. And I don't know if anybody's performing them here in the United States anymore.
The closing of the Amato Opera House was such a loss.
Yeah.
It was an absolute loss.
Happened not that long ago, maybe 20 years ago now. 20,
no, it's 15? Less, I think.
Yeah, yeah, 10, 15. I mean, it's all, to me, the year 2000 was yesterday, and it's 20 years ago. So I'm always hesitant to put a timestamp on anything. But Reba, give our audience an introduction to this amazing art form, because it does have two lives. It has the life of the Sceneggiata Nobildonna in Italy, and then the sort of second city of this art form happens after the First World War with the massive immigration here in New York City. And the Italian immigrant theater does have its own sort of version and its own livelihood. So could you give a brief history to everybody about how this art form comes to be and what are its sort of key characteristics?
Yeah, absolutely. And I apologize for one of my dogs barking. So in Naples, the Sceneggiata was a staged sung theater that basically had three core stock characters, Iso, Essa, and Malamente, or him, her, and the bad guy, literally. And they revolved around plots of revenge and violence. Usually it ended with the bad guy giving the woman a slash across the face. As people started immigrating to the United States, of course, they wanted to bring their traditions with them. And so at this point, when people were bringing the Sceneggiata across to New York and other places, basically the core was in Little Italy in New York, but they changed it up and they started writing music about missing home. So we think of the mother songs, you know, songs about missing mother, like Senza Mamma, or things like Lacrime Napolitano, where he's singing about writing a letter to his mother. But mother songs actually were a core aspect of immigrant musical theater, not just in Italian-American musical theater, but also Yiddish musical theater and German musical theater. So they had that kind of trait. And I'm not entirely sure if because everyone was concentrated in this small area, if they kind of picked up on that, or it was just a general thing of missing one's mother, which is very, very likely. And so they started writing songs about missing home, writing songs about Italy, writing songs about mothers. And so you go from this genre that in Italy was all about violence and betrayal to now this kind of soft almost version of, you know, now. And one of the things I love about the Godfather scene is that it was so popular that people would go for about a week without eating lunch just to save enough money to go buy a ticket. It was a very communal experience. There are stories in some Italian newspapers where people are said to be embracing random strangers at certain moments. Like, for instance, somebody's mother on stage dies, or they get word that their mother dies, and then they just randomly start crying and turn to their neighbor and start hugging their neighbor. So it became not just a form of entertainment, but a place to build community in this new land.
I think it was very general to the immigrant experience, because all the Irish Tora Laura Laura songs, like Danny Boy, that was the Irish American equivalent of it, because those songs were written here and then went back to Ireland.
Right.
No one in Ireland is writing about missing Ireland. That's why all those Irish songs mention counties and places, because they were all, I think Gangs in New York probably portrayed it best.
Yeah.
Because the Irish were here earlier and they would buy tickets and they would go to these dance musicals, I guess you would say. And you'd have someone up there who would just sing about missing Ireland. And that's why they were written in English and not in Irish, at a time when Irish was still the dominant language in Ireland. And I think that if you want to see, for those of our listeners who are not familiar, they're trying to picture what this is. If you can't see, well, I guess the early turn of the century version would be Senza Mamma in Godfather 2. But I think Pasqua della Sette Bellezze, which was the Lena Wertmüller film that came out in the 70s, also has a scene with the Sceneggiata. And I think that really the last Sceneggiata artist, I don't know, Reba, if you would agree, would be Mario Merola, who just died a couple years ago.
Yep. There's actually, I think on at least it used to be, on YouTube, a great version of him singing Lacrimena, which whenever I teach the genre to my students, I actually use that version for a variety of reasons. But it also kind of gives a student a taste of, you know, this notion of, again, the wanting to go back and kind of make sure that your mom is okay, and writing her letters and missing home, and this notion of how many tears will us Neapolitans have to cry, and all of that. That stuff that was really integral to the immigrant experience that found its way into the genre.
And Meadow made movies. He and some of them were actually filmed in the United States.
Yes.
And they were Shinojata type movies. If you rent them and watch them, I think they're brilliant. Because they just, if you get the genre, they're just so well done.
Yeah.
I think him and Gigi D'Alessio had a scene, Mario Meadow Dies. Did you ever see this one?
Which one?
Mario Meadow is dying. He has a heart attack. That's as a character.
I think I saw that one.
And he's getting Senzite Finisce Nabla. Without you, Naples is finished. And it's just, it's everything. You know, you have, because the Shinojata was almost like a tableau. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really cinematographic acting. You could see they're acting. It's almost like they're performing a ceremony. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you have Gigi D'Alessio singing to Mario Meadow, send that definition out, but without you, Naples is finished. There's people, and Gigi D'Alessio was also a singer. He was kind of the anointed heir in a career sense to take over from Mario Meadow. You have all these Neapolitan women standing around the stretcher going into the ambulance. But it's like the dramatic Neapolitan acting, where it's almost kind of funny. It's kind of a little bit purposely overdone, which kind of... Do you agree with that? Do you see where I don't know if I really well interpret that, but the Neapolitans, no, people would sing along. People would go into these theaters and the actor, you know, the singer would get up there and he would start singing about the mother. And they probably saw those shows five times because they kept saving up for it and watching it. And then as true Neapolitans, you know, what was the complaint at the San Carlo Opera House was the Neapolitans would sing, would comment, would throw tomatoes. Like, they were very engaged in the performance. And I think even with the popular art form of Shinojata, they were equally engaged. So almost it became like, I would say, like a music hall, a little bit of Mitch Miller sing-along. Would you agree with that, Reba?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of things. So, I mean, you know, being a New Yorker, I have to throw some Yiddish in here. And of course, I'm also Jewish, so that'll do it too.
But you're half Italian. I don't know if they know that.
Yeah, I know. I'm what my friends affectionately call a pizza bagel. it's very schmaltzy acting. You know, it's so overdone and it's so, like you said, obviously, like, exaggerated. But, I mean, to your point about the singing along, this was also at the point, at least in New York City, where sheet music became a commodity. And people would not just go to these shows, but they would also go and they would buy the sheet music. And so in my frustration of trying to look for some of Francesco Panino's stuff, I have a good friend who is a librarian at the library.
Just explain to him who Francesco Panino is.
Francesco Panino was probably the most prolific and greatest Shinojata composer in the United States. Also Francis Ford Coppola's grandfather. And so my friend who works in the music division of the Library of Congress actually pulled out the copyright stuff to see if they have it. Because when you do a copyright deposit, you have to deposit a piece of music. And so the sheet music for some of his stuff does exist. And the copyright hasn't been renewed. So my friend was able to scan me a few of these. But the point is that not only were these shows being mounted in the theaters, but the sheet music was being sold. So even if you went to see the show once and you really loved it, you could conceivably go to your nearest sheet music theater on Mulberry Street and buy a copy of the sheet music. Because a lot of people also had some access to some sort of instrument, whether it was a piano or a mandolin or something, where that they can go and they can play it and sing it at home. So it just happened to coincide at the time where sheet music production was really part of the music industry in New York.
That's interesting. And that harkens to our great friend, John.
Yeah, I was just going to say that you know, for those listeners who have heard us speak about or watched our videos on YouTube with Ernie Rossi, company is a 120-year-old store, still doing great stuff on Mulberry Street here in Little Italy in Manhattan. And it started out with Ernie's grandfather as a music store, as a, you know, a writer, a copywriter of music, sheet music production. I know player piano roles were a big part of their inventory for a long time. I mean, Ernie's like a huge resource on the history of this stuff. And we always laugh because he's got stuff stored from 120 years ago in his basement that I'm sure would be a treasure trove to someone like you, Reba, who's passionate about this. But yeah, you take for granted how much this meant to the immigrant community and how much of this stuff was actually written here in the United States about the Italian-American experience. It's interesting because, you know, we have a community nowadays. I feel like the popular canzone napoletana, the Neapolitan songs of, you know, Torno Sorrento or O Sole Mio and things that people know intrinsically, even if they don't know what it means, you know, they've heard them growing up with their parents, their grandparents, whatnot. That's made its way around the world. I remember there was a time where the Venetian city council, I believe, basically barred the gondoliere from singing songs that were Neapolitan songs because they weren't authentic to Naples. But for much of the world, Neapolitan music is the soundtrack they hear in their mind when they think of Italy and all of Italy. But we sort of have this great gap that's undiscovered because this music that came with us that has been passed down that is so purely Neapolitan and so now Italian in the mind of so many precedes and survives into our generations. But then there's this whole wealth of creative energy in the music of the sceneggiata or the immigrant theater here in the United States that's telling very intimately and very and at a very basic level the story of the early immigrants. And so to be able to find and revive and often, obviously, as is necessary now, translate these kind of works, they're a wealth of first-person primary source material on the Italian-American experience that I think most of us just don't have even an understanding of, let alone an access to. Do you find that this kind of stuff gives you a different insight into the early Italian-American experience, Reba?
Oh, absolutely. I it always makes me really sad that it's not more accessible for a variety of reasons. When we think about the sceneggiata, we think about it as being the Neapolitan experience, but it's really the whole Italian kind of experience. I mean, I mentioned that my grandparents, one was from Sicily and one was from Calabria. And we have all of these different kind of, we have all of these experiences in common, no matter if you come from Calabria or Sicily or Naples or wherever. And so even if you weren't Neapolitan, you would probably go and see these shows. It doesn't really matter if the dialect is different because it was, again, this communal experience. And it was to kind of reflect on what you're dealing with in terms of trying to, heaven forbid, say the word, assimilate.
If you go into The Godfather, there's Sicilians watching a Neapolitan production.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Don, I always get his name wrong, John. Don Finucci, what was his name?
Yeah, yeah.
Don Finucci complains, all this Neapolitan music, when are they going to sing a Sicilian song?
Yeah, it's true, but it also leads to what you said, talk about, Pat, a lot, right? And we love to cover on the show, which is like in the era after the Second World War, as the languages are on a decline, you do get this sort of pan-Italian-American pigeon that comes out to where you're using part Neapolitan and part Sicilian and, you know, certain words from Pugliese, whatever it is, and then English tied into it, and you get this sort of language mix that exists for a brief moment in the Italian-American experience where they've found a functional way for all these people who come from different regional backgrounds and different regional languages to communicate in their own internal language that is sort of pan-Italian-American. And I think that that's really fascinating.
I disagree with you on this point, and I'm not rooting for the home team on this. This is not me, Neapolitan propaganda. That Neapolitan sceneggiata music was to that generation what Tuscan Italian via Rai was to the post-war generation. And a Sicilian who goes to the theater and has to understand Neapolitan to enjoy it, he can speak Neapolitan better than a Neapolitan could speak Sicilian. And I think that that's why the Italian-American pigeon in the New York metro area, where sceneggiata was huge, is so heavily Neapolitan. I think that's that the sceneggiata was equivalent to Rai. But, you know, there was a lot of the sceneggiata migrated onto the radio. So you have sceneggiata in the theater, or you're paying for the theater before World War I, which everybody was, I guess the Italian-American version of vaudeville. And then much of it stays in theater, but a lot of it migrates to radio. And I would love to have Floyd Vivino on to discuss this. You know, you had programs like Pasquale COD out of New York, where a whole part, the whole basis of the show, and it's lost, it was never recorded, was one Italian-American comedian, Pasquale COD, impersonating, playing different characters on the radio show and doing them in different regional languages, aka dialects. And they found this hilarious. So there was the Barese character, the Sicilian character, the Calabrese character. There was all these different characters that came in, and they all spoke with a different dialect, regional language. And my grandmother's generation thought it was hilarious. Like I actually saw the death, the last vestiges of this, the Italian Catskills in the 80s. Just like Dirty Dancing, there's an Italian version of that type of resort, Villa Roma and Villa Vosilla that were up there. And these Italian-American comedians would have punchlines in different dialects or do impersonations. The Barese was always considered the funniest for obvious reasons, because Barese is a kind of fun language. And people thought it was absolutely hilarious.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You talk about the, you know, if you look at Dirty Dancing and the Borscht Belt and the Jewish resorts, there was a very similar and parallel and equally thriving bocce belt, as they called it, that existed 100%. In the Catskills. And believe it or not, there's actually more bocce belt resorts still around today than there are Borscht Belt resorts. I mean, there's a few hangers-on and survivors that have evolved forward. But yeah, I think that's the idea that, you know, what you went from theater to radio to these kind of resort destination performances, and you can still get records made in the 40s and 50s, and some, I mean, I've got some even into the 70s, where though you know, much of it is in English, but the punchlines are still in the regional languages, dialects, whatever you want to call them, and that presumed that a large part of the audience understood something, some phraseology in one or more of those regional languages. And it's a window into a very unique point in our social experience, because the language hadn't died out to the point where that wasn't hitting with an audience anymore. If you tried to pull that kind of humor off now, with the exception of recent people who've immigrated since the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, you'd lose that. You'd lose 9/10 of the Italian American community. But back then, even through like the 70s, you could still hit that punchline with the majority of people. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that this kind of sceneggiata, whether it was in Neapolitan or not, was something that was inclusive of all types of Italian Americans.
I think that also, you know, to your point about the language dying out, I mean, I don't know about you, but I know around probably in the 1950s or 60s, there was this common idea that you would only speak the language when you didn't want your children to know what you were talking about, which is why my mother never learned Italian. Her sister and brother never learned Italian, because my grandfather and his parents and his siblings only spoke Italian when they didn't want the kids to know what they were talking about. Same reason my dad didn't learn Yiddish, because his parents only spoke Yiddish when they didn't want him to know what he was talking about. And so it has this effect of language loss, where there's a whole generation that just doesn't know the language, except for, like Pat was saying, you know, the pigeon. Like the joke among my friends and I is that it took me until I was about 25 to realize that gabagool is not a real word.
Yeah.
No, it is a real word.
Well, yeah, okay.
It's a Neapolitan pronunciation.
I know.
Some woman, I'm going to track her down one day and have a conversation, wrote in the Star Ledger. I always call it the I know more than you Italian American. And in New Jersey, they're all in Essex County, with all due respect. It's like you have them in a concentration. And they love to correct your Italian all the time, right? They're the one that goes, no, it's prosciutto. No. That's a different word. Your grandma said Brazut when she was living on Bloomfield Avenue in Newark, because that's the Neapolitan pronunciation. And the fact that you did 4 years at a New Jersey college and took Italian, and that you could now say capocollo, does not make you an intrinsically better human being than me. Because you don't even know why, that it's two different words for the same product in two different languages. So they're not that, I don't know, the gabagool, because, you know, New Jersey Star Ledger, New Jersey, oh, gabagool. They hammer these words in. They do not understand.
Reba, you bring up an interesting point about the sort of hesitancy to transfer these languages in these immigrant groups. And, you know, having the experience in your life of a mother who's not inheriting the Italian and a father who's not inheriting the Yiddish, I think that it's easy. You know, we're talking about the Bocce Belt and the Borscht Belt and the immigrant theater in both communities. I've noticed in recent years, there's been an effort in the Jewish community in New York to revive, wherever possible, performances of this immigrant theater. I think there's a foundation actually dedicated to it. And I've seen some success stories here throughout the city. And I don't think that many members of the Jewish community are fluent in Yiddish anymore. So it's got its own sort of obstacles in translation. What are the efforts that exist for the Italian American community? I mean, first of all, do you know of the success stories in the Yiddish theater, and is there a model for us? Because it doesn't seem like we've done the same kind of work.
Yeah, so I have a really dear friend who works at YIVO, which is a Jewish cultural organization down around 16th Street in New York. And so she and I actually met because we were on the same panel for the Society for American Music. I was presenting on the Shana Jatha and she was presenting on Yiddish theater. And so that's her thing, is Yiddish musical theater. And so she had a very, very, very difficult time finding someone to actually teach her Yiddish, because unlike Italian, when Yiddish dies off, like, it dies off. And there are very few people who can speak it fluently who are not self-taught. So there is an organization in New York called Workman's Circle. And if you don't know about Workman's Circle, it was an organization that was built to basically serve the Eastern European and specifically Jewish community, the immigrant community. And a lot of Jews were members. My grandparents were members. In fact, they were such a big group that in Jewish cemeteries, often they have little areas for different lodges and different groups. And Workman's Circle has a section in one of the Jewish cemeteries in New Jersey where my grandparents are buried, and a whole host of other Workman's Circle members. They have a nursing home in the Bronx still that exists. And Workman's Circle was the place that my friend tried to go and find someone. And it took her a very, very long time, but she was able to find one person. I believe he was in his mid to late 80s, to teach her Yiddish so that she can do her work.
Wow.
I have one friend who is in her, well, I think she's in her early 30s. She's self-taught, but she is fluent in Yiddish and she does teach Yiddish. So there aren't very many Yiddish speakers left, and it's been really difficult. There has been a very big push to revive Yiddish musical theater. I know Michael Ox has been creating editions and mounting them in Manhattan. So there are productions of Yiddish theater, and I think we can use those as a model. I think the problem that we're facing is that we don't have the materials. There's some stuff, I believe, at the Calandra Center at Queens College. There's some stuff at the Library of Congress. There's probably lots of stuff in Ernie's basement. We have the stuff in Francis Ford Coppola's possession. There's probably stuff in other people's basements. But beyond that, we don't know where these things are. We are complete scores and complete scripts of these things are. Even libretti, we may not have a libretto for something, so it makes it that much more difficult. And I think if we're going to try and resurrect this, which was actually one of the reasons why I got into this, was to try and see if we can resurrect the genre, we need access to the materials, or we just can't do it.
Have you seen any of Alfredo Bachetta's work?
I have not, but I know I need to.
I think he's the most accessible. Alfredo Bachetta was born in 1889. He died in 1982. He's the one that wrote Love Bashk. And I love Love Bashk as an example, because...
Just translate for the audience. That's the Easter eggs.
Easter egg, yeah. He wrote... There was a lot of these Shana Jatha works between a wife complaining to her husband. You don't buy me a Christmas gift. You didn't get me anything for Easter. You stink. And he goes back at her. And they have a fight and then they make up. That was kind of a common. And I think a lot of it was because you had a lot of young people coming from Italy, marrying here. So it was kind of like the newlywed couple's spat, you know, the lover's quarrel, which you can find on YouTube. Because what happened was a lot of these records were made in New York and then sold in Italy. Italian Americans were working. They were making money. They could buy these works. So the real production was done here. I love to give it to Neapolitans in Italy because he is one of the first examples of using Italian American words. So he'll use words like bag for bag instead of busta in Italian. You know, I don't even think a Neapolitan could understand of it. And in Love Bashki, he says, I Jersey City, right? You pick it up. He's complaining about going from Manhattan to have to go buy something in Jersey City. But Bachetta did. John, we actually used one of Bachetta's works. Last year when we did the episode about Al Smith,
yeah,
he wrote the song about Al Smith for Italian Americans to go out and vote for Al Smith, whose grandfather was Italian. He wrote a song that was very popular on a very serious subject of Sacco and Vanzetti. So there were fun Sceneggiata songs, and he was definitely the king of the fun song. But he also wrote on some very serious topics. And I think that they were, the Sceneggiata music was very much, it was a musical articulation of what was in the immigrant's experience at that time. Be it, you know, being married and away from home and your spouse is driving you up a wall, or feeling threatened because of what happened to Sacco and Vanzetti, or saying, well, Al Smith is part of time, we're going to go out and vote for him and support him. It all came out in the Sceneggiata. I don't know, Reba, do you concur with that?
Definitely. I mean, and then again, this idea of common experience of coming here and getting married. So fun story, which I love to tell because it's just so ridiculous. My uncle, my mom's brother, decided he was going to try and kind of track the family tree all the way back as far as he could. And he was able to pull my great-grandfather's ship manifest from when he came from Taverna, Italy. It wasn't until my uncle pulled the ship manifest that we realized that he was already married in Italy. And he came here and married my grandmother.
Wow.
And he never went back to Italy. It's been unclear as to whether or not he was sending money back to this woman that he was married to or whether he was actually corresponding with her. But he basically just up and left Italy. The ship manifest had him listed as married. And he never went back to Italy marrying my grandmother.
Wow. My grandmother.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much, you know, the research pans out and people don't. I mean, it's the same thing as these kind of plays, right? You don't think about what can be found with a little digging and putting clues together. And Pat references the Al Smith song or the Sacco Vanzetti song. I buy up as much as I can old records produced here in the United States that are on immigrant themes, or if I can buy stuff digitally, because again, you know, finding something like the Al Smith song, which yes, we used in our episode on Italian Americans in politics, it gives you insight that would really otherwise be lost, because so many Italian Americans, you know, are, if they're reading on our history, it's usually broad stroke stuff, and it would be a very difficult task to find, you know, a book in English on the Italian American reaction to Al Smith. And it's obviously not a huge part of his biography because he didn't focus on his Italianness in particular, as he was more Irish and German. But so when we have these songs, it's a direct and primary source into popular thought in the community. And I think that that's a real treasure, because you need enough people thinking in a certain way to write a song that they can relate to about it that's going to sell and be commercial. So it tells you a little bit, I think, sociologically, of where the mindset was of the community. And for me, that's the big draw in this idea of immigrant theater, is that unseen aspect of what was popular and social conception and sort of agreed upon understanding. And I admire, Reba, your effort to find and preserve these things. It sounds like the effort really needs to be put into tracking down these whole productions and finding them where we can. Are you on this task alone? Are there others like you that are out there interested in this stuff? Do you have allies in this great battle ahead to bring back and revive what we can?
So there's a few people, one who recently just passed away, sadly. So if you don't know about this book, it's a fantastic book, Italian Birds of Passage by Simona Frasca, who talks about the diaspora of Italian musicians in, specifically Neapolitan musicians in New York. But there's very little about the Sceneggiata in America. There's a few books on it in Italy as an Italian genre, but not as an Italian-American genre. And I think part of the problem is that we're so limited in being able to access these materials. Plus, there were at least three of us who were trying to track these materials down and gain access to them, and none of us have been successful. So it's a labor of love, but it's turned into something that has become really frustrating because we keep hitting dead ends.
Yeah, that's got to be very tough. I think you're right. I think Ernie's basement might be the key, because I've been given the incredible privilege of having access to some of his storage facilities. And I can tell you, it's like the scene at the end of Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they wheel the Ark of the Covenant into the storage facility, and you just sort of pan out and see stacks and stacks and stacks of crates, and you know this thing is never coming out of there because it's just going into like the ether. Ernie's storage facilities are quite a bit like that. So I'm hopeful that in there is something that can be captured and preserved and brought out into the 21st century, because, you know, again, like I say, you so much to be learned from what these people were writing about, singing about, thinking about. Are any of the American creations being utilized in Italy? Is there a relationship to our version in the people in Italy that still work on and still promote the Neapolitan Cinerata?
I think there is, and I think that they are still being performed with some regularity. So that's one difference, is that, you know, that these are things that they have access to, and they're part of this culture. It's kind of like opera. Opera's never going to go away. Thankfully, it's never going to go away. And one of the benefits of, at least if we tried to do some of these stagings, if we find this material, is that it's out of copyright. Mm. And so we don't have to worry about dealing with copyright issues and dealing with permissions and things like that, which is nice. But then I think also it brings another thing into the picture, which is performance. We don't have a clear picture of performance style, acting style, unless you were trained specifically in Neapolitan opera or the intermezzo. You probably have no experience singing in Napolitan. So that also is another thing, because singing in Napolitan and singing in Tuscan Italian are two very different things. So there's got to be some sort of training there that happens to make sure that the diction and the pronunciation.
Right. There's still music being written in Neapolitan, contemporary, 100%.
Oh, yeah.
And there's still musical performers who perform this Cinerata music at confirmations and communions and not big wedding performances, but even small family parties, anniversaries. It's there. It's just, I think what's changed is it's not a dominant form of the musical entertainment that it was, let's say, in the past. I don't want to put a time on it and say 30 years ago, 100 years ago. So I think it's more like almost a specialty, if you'd like to say, or a subset. But I don't know if you would say it was a dominant, it didn't have the domination of place. It's almost like waltzes, you know, if you go to the 19th century in the time of Gattopardo, you know, everybody's doing the waltz, everyone knows how to waltz. And now it's almost like a specialty. Not as much as that, but I think that's the best way to kind of...
Yeah, it's like historical reenactment almost.
I don't know, because I follow this closely. I mean, there's definitely channels in Naples, television channels, where it plays all the time. I'll put it to you this way. The most recognized song in the world, I think, is O Sole Mio, which is a Neapolitan Giotto type time period song. No one outside of Naples is going to know a Cinerata performed song today that is not coming from that time period. So the new work does not get the exposure, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Reba, let me ask you a question. Speaking to that point, you know, Cinerata really begins after World War I and begins to see a dip after World War II. So you're talking about a little bit before World War I, right? So like the early 1900s to the 40s and into the 50s, so like half a century arc. But then in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you do get a lot of actors like Mario Merola, who we mentioned before, who take this art form into Italian cinema as well. So like Merola makes many, many movies over the course of his career that are basically Cinerata plays just put on in front of a camera and recorded for posterity. What did those films mean to Italian cinema, to the immigrants that could still speak in Neapolitan? And now what do they mean in terms of preservation? What can we find on there if people want to go back and access the movies from the 50s through the 70s?
Well, to take the last point first, I think that it's a treasure trove of style. So even if they were not the traditional kind of like early 1900s sort of Cinerata, there is a through line of that tradition in metal itself. So it's a place to see the stylistic properties, if you will, of the genre. And I think there was at a certain point around the 1950s and 60s where television, theater attendance started to drop a little bit. And so same with movies. As movies started to get, especially sound films, and we started to get Dolby and stereo and all of these technological things that make sound really pop in a theater, I think that people were more inclined to go to a theater or to buy a VHS or to get access these films than go to the theater. Because even now, it's cheaper, let's face it, it's cheaper to go to a movie than it is to go see a play.
Right.
So you can see that same film maybe four times for the price of a theater ticket. And so it was a way for people to more economically access this material. And so I think that it became a shift in access to performance, where you could watch it whenever you wanted to on these recordings. You could buy them, you could build a library, you could introduce them to your children, because once they were out of the theaters, if they were in the theaters, then that's it. But now it's the way you kind of pass this music down. So I think that that sort of stuff, the later stuff, if we're using authentic, I hate that word authentic, but if we're going to use it for this case, authentic early 20th century, it's a good way to kind of get this taste of it and to expose people to a genre that's no longer being performed and really even no longer being written.
What is your students' reaction?
So I don't know if you've seen the clip from Lacrime Inabilitan where Merala is standing at, I think he's standing in Hoboken, and he's reading.
That's Brooklyn. That's the Brooklyn. He filmed that in the 70s, yes.
Yes.
He came to Brooklyn in the 70s and filmed that.
Yes. And so that's the clip that I show my students. And, you know, his mother is back home and she's covering the plate all sad. She's left this plate of pasta for him at dinner and he's not going to be there. And my students actually get quite a kick out of it because, again, the schmaltz factor, this exaggeration, like, okay, we get it. Your mother misses you. You miss your mother. Can we move on? Or even when I show them the clip from The Godfather where, you know, he reads his mother, this note that his mother's dead. And the first thing he does is he grabs the gun to put it to his head, and then the woman's like, oh my goodness. So my students always get a kick out of how exaggerated it is.
It's not really exaggerated if you're Neapolitan. But you know,
I mean, Pat, most of my students when I show this were MSU students, so you know, most of them were not Neapolitan.
Yeah, they're completely, but they're removed from that,
right?
They're completely, they've never encountered anyone in their life who reacted to stuff like throwing a shoe across a room or smacking their face or pulling their cheeks or pulling their hair out in anger.
Right.
They're from the chill world.
Right. So, I mean,
never seen drama.
Yeah.
As I mean, daily that, part of your life.
That dramatic aspect, it overly dramatic is how they think of it. But musically, they react to the deep emotion that's present, not just in the text, because before I even play it for them, I give them the translation and I ask them what they think that they're going to see and hear when they get this. And they pick up on the emotion in the text, but they always say that that emotion musically is amplified once they start singing, because there's just that core part of Neapolitan song in or out of Shinajata that's very emotional, that's very melodic, it just reflects an experience. And it's really hard to describe, but the students always pick up on how emotional these songs are. And so if you put aside the acting, there's a lot contained within that music that is much, much different than anything that they've ever heard before.
Fall favorites are back on Mediaset Italia, all the shows you love to cozy up on the couch with. Italian family favorites whipped up in the kitchen with Cotto e Mangiato. All eyes are back on the Grande Fratello VIP house with a brand new season and a fresh crop of contestants. A double dose of Maria De Filippi with the return of new episodes of Amici and Uomini e Donne. And the game show that puts you in the hot seat, Caduta Libera, and host Jerry Scotti will test your wits. Mediaset Italia has all the best entertainment from Italy year-round. Call your local television provider and ask for the channel today.
It's interesting to me because I learned a lot of Neapolitan music growing up phonetically, listening to it with my grandfather, with my dad, with my mom's parents. And as I got older and became an Italian language speaker and then integrated what I had learned growing up of Neapolitan and Sicilian and sort of put all these pieces together, I started to translate songs on my own. And then eventually the internet caught up and you could find translations a lot easier. And it is true that, you know, even when the topic is not as grave as I'm going to kill myself because my mother died, even when the topic is something like Solimio and the Sun, the topic doesn't have to be terribly deep in order for the song to have a depth. There's nothing flippant about Neapolitan music. You know, you can say what you want about modern pop music, but sometimes it's a little bit flippant in terms of the topic. And there's always a depth to the Neapolitan song, even when they're writing about something like not being home for Christmas in La Grande Abolidana. You know, there's something so deep. And when you can translate the work, I mean, you can translate the lyrics, even when you don't know what the lyrics mean, it's moving in its melody and the way it's sung. When you then translate it, it adds a whole other level of depth. And I think that La Grande Abolidana, you know, people always ask what is like the Italian-American national anthem. And some people say it's Che La Luna, or some people say it's Malafemmin and things. But for me, it's always La Grande Abolidana, because that's the song that explains this immigrant missing his home on Christmas. And when you read those lyrics, it really does take you into the mindset of the singer and of the writer. I don't know, there's just something very useful to me, not only in translating these regional languages to a modern generation, but also translating the depth of the immigrant experience. I think that that's what the real beauty of these things is. And I think that when people know these songs, like I did phonetically, and can maybe kind of sing along in their best version of it, it adds something so deep when they finally get to read a translation of what the lyrics are.
You know, I think that Neapolitan form of music is so often portrayed by detractors as dramatic, when in fact it's really visceral.
Yeah.
So the death of a mother, you're a million miles away, you're in America, you'll never see your mother again, you're not going to be at a wake, you're not going to be at a funeral, you don't know if she was calling for you at the end. It was the death of a mother compounded by everything else, being in a foreign country, killing yourself for work, not being there, and it just all comes out of you. There's no stop on the tap. So I think if you have a visceral culture like Neapolitan culture, you're going to have songs that can be physically portrayed, because the physical portrayal of the song is just one more step in being visceral. That's why they pull their hair out at funerals and smack their face, because they outwardly express their internal turmoil. And I think that's a cultural thing that a lot of people who don't understand it just write it off as drama. But let me ask you another question, Reba. Wasn't there a tax benefit to Sceneggiata for the performers in Naples? Isn't that what kind of spurred on the...
Yes.
The genre?
Yes, there was, actually. And I forget exactly what it was. I know there had something to do with there were certain genres that were taxable and not taxable, and it had to do with musical theater.
There was a tax break. If you had movement, if you had acting while people were singing, you were classified basically as an opera, and that was tax-free. So if you just sang, you were kind of taxed because it was considered like a crooner in a bar for modern parlance. So the Neapolitans had movement. They had acting, basically. Whenever they sang in, it would be the modern version of the saloon in Italy, you know, the taverna or the theater. Because if you had acting along with the music, you weren't taxed. So that was, and you were in that opera category. You didn't have the same taxation. So that's why everyone in Naples was acting with the music, because they didn't have to pay that tax.
Which is one of the reasons why it became such a pervasive genre, because they figured out that loophole and they would just keep
writing. Which is so Neapolitan. they're gonna find that loophole.
But I think that that's the beauty of it, because I think for me, I always think of this, you know, like I say, right, we lost not that long ago the Amato Opera House, and it performed opera like you would think of at the Met, but in the operetta style usually, which is the piano and the singers. But the troupe there also performed these kinds of Sceneggiata immigrant theater, and they are sort of distant cousins, right? The tax credibility or the musical credibility, that they come from the same font. And I always love the idea that, like, you know, opera is a great Italian gift to the world. And I think Naples nowadays doesn't get the credit that it deserves for its role in the earliest forms of opera, but opera is oftentimes not particularly revelatory. It's very high level stuff, and a lot of opera is inspired by ancient history and scenes from historical epics that I think nowadays people just don't really relate to. But this is the opera of the street. This is the opera of the contemporary. This is the opera of your own experience. I think it's opera, operetta, whatever you want to call it, inspired by a life that the majority of people can understand and can relate to. And I think that that's something really beautiful about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
If people want to go online and they want to learn about this, I think if they want to see the modern Sceneggiata of the 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s, there's Mario Merola, and I maybe we could put a link on for that. But Alfredo Bachetta, I think, is absolutely, he's fantastic, because he is from that great migration era, right? The teens, the 1920s, and his, so you can go on YouTube and listen to his work. But for those studying Neapolitan, it is a completely pure Neapolitan. Because even as Neapolitan as Merola's work is, it still has influences of linguistic changes that came from the Italian language. Minimal, but they are there. The complete pure Neapolitan, the untainted Neapolitan, the Neapolitan that was spoken in New York by those early immigrants, that's Alfredo Bachetta 100%. That is the guy you listen to get the full experience. But another person I don't think we spoke about, and Reba, I don't know how much familiarity you have with, Gino Maringola. Gino Maringola was a Neapolitan performer. He died not that long, about 10 years ago. He was very old at the time. He did a Sceneggiata work in Neapolitan in New York in the 1950s. So they would produce it in New York. Stories like, you know, the pilgrimage to Montevergine. So they're from Naples to Montevergine. So they're taping that in New York, selling it to an Italian-American audience, and then going back to Naples and selling it in Naples. Because the money for that kind of work was here in New York. So it's so funny that you had somebody like Gino Maringola going back and forth to Naples, taping in Naples. And Gino Maringola, really, if you want, Pat's three people to listen to really understand this, from the teens and 20s, Alfredo Bachetta, pure Neapolitan. Gino Maringola, also pure Neapolitan in the 50s. It's more modernized as far as the subject matter. Fantastic routines. You can find them online. He did a lot of records also about saints, because they sold, you know, unique saints from Italy, because in the Italian-American community, they sold big time. Plus, he did a lot of comedy routine with his, he'd have a spouse on there, and there were a lot of kind of sometimes double entendre things that would come in, very much of his time. And then you have Mario Merola, who did almost everything in Naples, but would film some stuff in New York, like he did Lagrima Napoletana. And he was the guy who brought Sceneggiata into movies. Now, there was Rocco DiRusso and Mary Sampieri, but I think that's more the Italian-American comedy routines that were done on records. And so many of them now, you can find them on YouTube.
Yeah, they were making those in through the 50s and 60s too.
Now, Rocco DiRusso's work and Mary Sampieri, they were mostly in English. Rocco DiRusso would speak broken English. That was his character. Mary Sampieri, who was Italian-American, would speak in English, but she was supposed to be the Irish wife. So he's always fighting with the Irish wife. She gets him so aggravated. And then he would start cursing in Neapolitan and curse her out. Or he would make a nasty comment about her in Neapolitan. And she would say, what does that mean? And he would say it meant something. Oh, it means I love you. They were actually hilarious. But that would be a great second volume to this.
Yeah, you know, you're not kidding.
John, you love producing these videos. Maybe you should go do a reenactment of a Sceneggiata.
Oh, I would love Manella. To. No, I think you're absolutely right, Pat. I think that's, if Reba can be out there, we'll do our best. Reba, we'll commit to you. We'll try to help you find, wherever we can, a complete version of this immigrant theater, the Sceneggiata. And if we do find it, I think it's going to fall to us as the sort of 21st century Italian-American platform to work on staging it and filming it.
Can't we call Francis Ford Coppola?
We'll give it a shot.
If you're out there listening, play ball with us. You know, like, we totally respect what your grandfather did. We can get famous Hollywood actors to reenact this.
Could you imagine that? That'd be great.
This is the sick stuff I think about when I have free time.
I think the real prospect for us is Ernie's Basement. There's got to be. There's got to be one of these.
That's Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, there's got to be.
That's your baby. You're like, nobody in the world is tighter with Ernie than you are.
I'm like the Italian American Indiana Jones, only looking for Italian American stuff. Yeah.
A pit helmet with a little kerosene light on top, and go down there.
I am willing to do some grant writing for us to get some grants to get that stuff digitized.
Yeah, we need to.
I'm totally on board with doing grant writing and doing this stuff so we can get some money to get this stuff digitized so it doesn't get lost.
Yeah.
Because it needs to go somewhere.
Well, if you're out there in the audience, if you're a passionate Italian American who maybe has somebody in your family tree or somebody in your community that you know that might have had something to do with this, and you might be able to point us in the right direction, let us know. Drop us a line, shoot us an email, find us on social media. Let us know if you have any idea where we might be able to access one of these complete works that are so indicative of where our community was and what we come from, an important topic, not just for our show, but for posterity, something that should be preserved. And maybe it's time that we got active in doing our part to make sure that it's found and preserved for future generations, because I think it's a great tool in understanding who we are and where we came from. So we're going to commit to it. And if you're out there and you are willing to help us, let us know. We'd certainly appreciate any help we can get. And Reba, we're going to work our end, and hopefully you do the same, and maybe we'll get to put this thing together in the not so distant future.
Reba, you have to do a book.
I want to. So I have an article out on it, but that's, I mean, again, I keep hitting these dead ends. So I need access to the materials.
We're going to break those dead ends.
All right,
we're going to break through.
Pat and I are going to work on it. That's our job. And I'm going to send our audience off today with, I think, a clip from Senza Mamma, sung by Mario Merola, I think, and just a great version of this important song. And highly recommend everybody going out and at least watching the clip from Godfather Part 2 so you can understand exactly what we're talking about, because it's a big part of who we are. So, Reba, thanks for being here today. We look forward to having you back in the future, and hopefully we'll be working on a project like this.
It was a great, great honor to have you. It was hopefully you'll come back again, and we will continue this conversation, because there's so much more to learn, Italian comedy, Italian-American comic theater, and the like, so.
Absolutely.
No, we look forward to having you back. And I hope everybody out there enjoyed and continues to search and read, and maybe you'll turn up one of the lost treasures of Sceneggiata and the Italian American Immigrant Theater and help us on our journey towards preserving this for the 21st century. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Da, 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 da. A sotto già de mamma e presto di nasto dalla fiamma dove m'amor ma la vetta ma la valetta sulle sperdute senza una voce che ha un forte cor senza l'amore mai.